All right. I would like to introduce our speaker for today, who will speak until 10:10, and then we'll have answer questions from the audience. Let's welcome Jim from La Habra.
Good morning. My name's Jim. I am an alcoholic. And the interest of full disclosure and as a partial apology to the citizens of La Habra, I'm actually from Whittier, so if you're here from La Habra, my apologies. Well, good morning. As I said, I am an alcoholic, and to people in this room, that probably brings a whole series of behaviors and mannerisms that you can identify with. I know, listening to folks speaking earlier, I was able to identify greatly with that which was being shared. The nervousness, the, you know, I'm not sure I want to do this kind of stuff. My sobriety date is March the 2nd, 1988. And I can assure you that the nervousness takes longer than 24 years to go away completely. Now, the good news is I can tell you that it dissipates. I am not as nervous today as I was, I don't know, sometime in late 88, early 89, something like that. I was asked to speak at a meeting, at a Saturday night meeting, a dress-up kind of meeting. And the way this worked, hey, you've been to one of those. The way this worked was I had gone to this meeting for a little while, and the speaker arranger person asked me one Saturday night, would I speak at next Saturday night's meeting? And I contemplated for about a millisecond and said, absolutely, yes. Some of the pauses and hesitations that you might hear in the presentation this morning is the acute awareness of this little electronic device here. My head is slowly filtering the obscenities out of my presentation is what's going on. So if it sounds like I'm stupid, it's not. If I look like I'm stupid, it's because I am. But be that as it may. But I was asked to speak at this Saturday night meeting. I was asked a week in advance. And for 6.5 days... I pretty much made myself crazy. Pretty much made myself crazy. And so Saturday afternoon, a couple of hours before I was supposed to speak at the meeting, I finally broke down and called my sponsor. Now, I had seen my sponsor any number of times during the course of the week. We went to meetings together. He required that I attend meetings with him. He was actively and busily taking my inventory long before I thought it was a good idea. But he required that I be there. So I'd seen him. I'd talked with him. I told him God knows how many times I was fine. Every time he asked me, how are you? I'm fine. Anybody not know what the acronym FINE stands for? Go. Okay. I was fine. But I was so fine by Saturday afternoon, I finally called him and said, Joe, I have to speak at a meeting tonight. And he said, really? And he said, what's the problem with that? I said, I don't know what to tell these people. And he said, when did you get asked to speak at this meeting? I said, a week ago. And he said, so for a week now, you have thought about this. I said, no, thinking about it is not sufficient. I don't know what to tell these people. And he did what he had done to me several times before that and many, many, many times after that. He was my sponsor for almost 17 years up until the day he died. But he answered my question just as directly and straightforwardly as anybody has ever answered my questions. When I asked him again, what it is that I should tell these people. He said, Jim, tell them the truth. And then he hung up on me. And I was incensed one more time. Why does he keep doing that? Why does he hang up on me? See, because I wanted to negotiate his answer. I wanted, you know, well, could I tell him about it? Wouldn't it be interesting if, gee, you know, it probably would be beneficial that. And that's not the way he saw my life at all. He saw my life with a clarity and a straightforwardness that I was incapable of. I just did not have the ability. And he wasn't hanging up on me. He was done talking. He was an engineer. He was a kind of black and white guy, really straightforward. But he was done talking. There was nothing more to discuss. And he knew me, and he knew me well, and he knew that my next step was absolutely to break out into negotiation mode. That's what I've done all my life. Let's make a deal. Let's make a deal. And that's not the way this program works. So, in the interest of telling you the truth, a few things about me. I grew up on the East Coast. I grew up in the suburbs of Boston. And my earliest recollection of alcohol with me, a lot of recollections regarding alcohol around me, but my earliest recollection of alcohol with me is it was after dinner on either Thanksgiving or Christmas. I'm not sure which, but both of those events in my house were big events, and there were lots and lots and lots of relatives. My last name's O'Connell, by the way. Very, very Irish. In fact, I am a member of the CIA. I am Catholic, Irish, and alcoholic. And as was the wont in those days, this would have been the mid-50s. Boy, it sounds like a long time ago. Would have been in the mid-50s, and the men had retired to the living room for cigars and after-dinner drinks. And the ladies were, of course, in the kitchen cleaning up. And it might have been the first time that I chose to go and be with the men. I was young enough, little tiny guy, five, six, somewhere in there. I would have been treated very nicely by all those ladies in the kitchen. They would have made a big deal out of me. The men were talking about business and football and things like that. And they weren't much interested in little boys. Little boys just kind of clogged up the machinery and got in the way. But I made the decision to be with the men. And I literally was sitting at my dad's feet. And the men are talking, and there's this wonderful blue haze of probably pretty good cigar smoke filling the living room. And I started tugging on my dad's pant leg. And he's got a sniffer of something, a little brandy glass of something. Let me try it. No. But, you know, my dad had his own struggles with his own issues, and they'd been at it for quite some time, so he finally relented. I'm sure, again, the idea was, let's just shut this kid up. And he finally reached down, and he said, just touch the tip of your tongue to the top of the liquid. You won't like it. You'll think it tastes terrible. Just touch the tip of your tongue. So I grabbed the glass from him and I slammed it back. Swallowed 2-3 ounces of what turned out to be Drambuie. And my memory is that much the way cartoon characters used to do it, I ran around the walls a couple of times. and panting and just carrying on and hooping and hollering. And I finally sat down and calmed down, and the tears stopped, and the sweat probably continued. But my thought was, that's good. I got to get me some more of that. And that set up what became a lifelong desire to acquire more alcohol. And I was able to do that. I acquired more alcohol, more alcohol, more alcohol. At one point, I actually had a bar. Bottles. I had bottles of stuff I didn't know I drank. I had a bottle of Tanqueray gin that I used to just look at. I hate gin. I hate gin. Drank the entire bottle of gin and the cooking sherry and everything else in between. Thank God I didn't have any Sterno, because my dad taught me how to drink that. And I was an alcoholic of the piggish type. I moved to California when I was very young. Somebody just yesterday or the day before asked me how I got to California, and I have a lovely story, and I frequently tell it, but the truth of the matter is, and again, Joseph Jankowski's admonition, tell the truth. Came to California in order to avoid prosecution. It was a flight to avoid prosecution on what one of our friends calls condiments charges. I drank alcohol, but there were condiments that went with the alcohol. Being respectful of the fact that this is an AA meeting, I won't talk about the condiments, but I was in possession of some significant quantities of condiments. The police were not happy about that, so we said bye-bye literally in the middle of the night. And moved to California, and I won't say began my criminal career, but continued my criminal career. I discovered at that point flight to avoid prosecution is a felony in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and it's also something else very unique. Flight to avoid prosecution is the only crime other than a capital offense for which there is no statute of limitations. In my head, I was just going to go to California for a little while, let it settle down, and go back to Massachusetts and live happily ever after. Well, that wasn't quite the case. Anyway, we got that straightened out, but I fell in love with California and began a career that involved lots and lots and lots of drinking. Ultimately, the drinking got to the point where I was in a profession. I was sales director, marketing director for an organization that sold furniture. We did one annual big event in Las Vegas, and if we did well, I could book enough business to generate income for the entire year. I literally could work like a dog for about 5 days in Las Vegas and book business that would keep the wolf away from the door for an entire year. Now, I'm a pig. I needed more money than that, and I would do some more business. But this was the backbone. This was the basis of my income for the whole year. And my routine was, I would go to Las Vegas. 2 weeks before I went to Las Vegas, I would stop drinking, and I would get sober. I'd certainly get dry. I would get brittle dry is what I would get. This last time, 1988. It was time to go to Las Vegas. It was a couple of weeks in advance of going to Las Vegas. And I couldn't stop, and I couldn't stop, and I couldn't stop. It'd be 10 days, 9 days. Finally got to be about a week, and maybe even a little less than that. And I was finally able to get the plug in the jug a little bit and made it to Las Vegas with a couple of days of sobriety. And went into DT's at the Las Vegas Hilton. and knew I was sick, knew I was in trouble, but decided that my problem was that I had a vitamin C deficiency. That was what it was. My menu had been so liquid and so alcoholic that I just wasn't getting the appropriate amount of vitamins. So I would call down to room service and I would have them send up a fruit plate, because this was going to take care of it. Another fruitarian here. This was going to take care of it. But the problem was when they showed up at the door knocking, room service, room service, room service, I wouldn't let them in. Just leave it at the door. You have to sign the ticket, slide it under the door. And it's these whole bizarre conversations going on between the doors, through the doors. I don't know how many times I did that, 2-3 times, something like that. The fruit was backing up in the hotel room. Second, third time, something like that, the hotel got quite concerned, and they sent up the house doctor with passkey and security. And for the second time in my drinking career, I got thrown out of a hotel. And the reason I got thrown out of that hotel was I was about to die, and they thought having a coroner's wagon pull up to even the back door of the Hilton would be bad for business. So they threw me out of the hotel. You're no longer welcome here. I managed to drive back to Los Angeles. At the time I was living in Pomona. It took me 2.5 days to drive from Las Vegas to Pomona. It's on a good day, it's about a 5-hour drive. It took me 2.5 days. The last day and a half of which California Highway Patrol were actively looking for me, according to them. They couldn't find me, which I'm not quite sure how hard they were looking, because passed out by the side of the road is where I was for much of that time. Got back to California. My then wife decided that I had a problem, and she took me to the doctor. And she was able, although not a doctor herself, she was able to diagnose my problem. And the problem was that I was taking too many Tylenol, according to her. We're not getting along real good at this point, by the way, oddly enough. She's over here in the room calling the doctor over, telling him, hey, Tylenol, handfuls of Tylenol. I was taking handfuls of Tylenol. She was absolutely correct in her observation, but the diagnosis was not accurate. And I would call the doctor back and say, I'm drinking a lot. I'm really drinking a lot. I knew I was in big, big trouble, and I wanted some help, but I couldn't ask for it. So I kept telling the doctor, and he would ask, well, how much? I said, more than a pint a day. Okay, and she'd call him back. He's taking bottles full of Tylenol. Back. Might even be as much as a fifth a day. Well, it was, the fact of the matter, it was a couple of quarts a day. I drank from the time I got up till the multiple times I passed out, because that certainly was part of my story. I would drink all day, pass out 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, come to 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. Starting to get to be winter again now. For those of you who are thinking about relapsing again, how about that 5 o'clock coming to time? And the question that pops to your mind is this: 5 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock in the afternoon? Remember those times? I was, doing all that kind of stuff. So I ended up in a treatment program March the 2nd, 1988 is the admit date. I used to use ended up in a hospital, which then ended me up in a treatment program. I used to use the last date the last day that I had a drink before I went to Las Vegas as my sobriety date. But I was sitting in another anonymous meeting that dealt with condiments one night after I had been sober. I thought I'd been sober for just about a year. And I was listening to a young lady just whine about not being able to stop taking pills. And I thought to myself, and one of those times, grateful I didn't say it out loud, I thought to myself, why don't you shut up and go find a real drug? I can't stop taking pills, and oh my God, and blah, 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 blah. But as just after I had that thought, the word Valium ran across my internal screen. While I had been in the hospital, what I remembered for the first time was every time the nurse would come around, every couple of hours, she'd come around with a little paper cup filled with pills. Some of them, oddly enough, were those vitamins that I really was deficient on. I think they told me they could find no evidence of vitamin K in my system whatsoever. But one of the pills they gave me was Valium. I knew what Valium was, and I would save the Valium. I'd scoop all the pills back up because I'd make the nurse tell me, what's this one, what's that one, every single time. They didn't change, but I made her tell me. I was concerned they were going to poison me. as opposed to the stuff I'd been doing to myself. And I would save the Valium, and I'd have five or six Valium at the end of the day, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, something like that, and I would take a handful of Valium just to get a little buzz, to get me through the night. And in this other anonymous meeting, I had that realization. I went to that same sponsor, and I said, Joe, I just had a thought. He said, uh-oh. But I told him the story. And I said, What do I have to do? And he said, well, you've been taking a lot of one-year chips, haven't you, Jim? I said, yeah, I have. He said, you've kept all those, haven't you, Jim? He knew I had a whole string of them and very, very enormously proud of them. And he said, you need to go back to each and every one of those meetings that you took a chip in. And you need to ask to chair, and you need to tell them the truth, what happened, and you need to give them their chip back. And the line in our book says, what an order, I can't go through with it. I just looked at him, and, how can you be making this request of me? This isn't fair, this isn't right. Again, I wanted to go into negotiation mode with him. And he looked at me and he said, if you do not do this, the chances of you staying sober for any length of time are very, very, very slim. So it's your choice. Do what you will. Let me know what you decide. And I did that. I managed to do that. I went back to every single one of those meetings. And I don't know but that the first one that I went to, I wasn't in tears with the shame and the ignominy of the whole thing as I told them the story about how I hadn't been sober for as long as I claimed I'd been sober, blah, 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 blah. The fact of the matter is the people in Alcoholics Anonymous are wonderful, kind, caring, loving human beings. They're different than people I've ever met anyplace else in my life. By about the second or third meeting that I went to return the chip to its rightful owner, I was looking forward to it because invariably people would come up to me afterwards and tell me, how proud they were of me, how brave I must be, blah, 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 blah. I was getting all these strokes for being a jerk and a liar. I can do this. I can do this. And I have been able to do this. I have been a faithful member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 24 years. I have 8,985 days of sobriety. I've never been this sober before in my life. I'm able to tell you that I have 8,985 days because I have an app on my iPhone that allows me to punch in my sobriety date. But I curse that app. A couple of years ago, we were on vacation up in Washington State, on a little island, Friday Harbor, and I discovered this app. I think we both discovered this app, and it does all the calculations for you. And I'm sad. I'm depressed about that because up until then, I used to do the math every so often, and I did it in my head, and and I did it in my head, and I did it including leap years. And that was, to me, so much evidence of my return to usefulness, the ability to do long multiplication in my head and do the carries and the gazintas and all that kind of stuff in my head was my proof that my life had really changed. And there was a time when I really, really, really needed that proof. I was desperate for that proof. Today, I find it in all kinds of little stuff. Sitting listening to some of the folks talking this morning when the meeting started, and it dawned on me. It was just one of those little pitter-patter thoughts that came in one ear, went out the other ear, didn't stay very long. But the realization from the time I woke up this morning till the time I got here, I did not curse the fact that this was what was the next indicated thing for me to do today. I didn't once say, damn, I got to go over to, Ron told me this is Tustin. Google Maps says it's Santa Ana, so I'm going to get it. It's Tustin adjacent. But I didn't once ever say, that stinks, crummy, loud, you know, why do I have, couldn't they get somebody who was close? I came from Long Beach, for God's sakes, zip codes away. I didn't once have that thought. I'm nervous. I was like, I don't like doing this, but I have a story in Alcoholics Anonymous. My story has some time attached to it, and they told me early on, do not refuse a reasonable AA request. Period. End of story. Somebody says, can you, would you, I need some. My answer has to be, yes, absolutely, you got it, no problem. Sure, I'm available, I can do that. Now, you know, between when the event takes place and when I say yes, do I complain and moan? Oh, sure. Guilty of being human. But do I show up? Do I bring the best me I possibly can? Absolutely. This is it. If you don't like my story in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll give you my phone number. You call me in about a year. God's not done with me yet. I have clear, ample evidence of that. I appear to have become a better human being each and every year that I've stuck around. I've had some emotional relapses. Year number 10 was not a particularly good year. At about 8 and a half, I decided 10 years was long enough to be sober. That's about right, 10 years. Because an alcoholic is somebody who can't stop drinking. I've been sober now for 8 and a half years. At that time, I'll be sober for 10 years. Clearly, I no longer fit the definition. Therefore, I must not be alcoholic. Year 10 was a tough year. I kept waiting to drink and waiting to drink. I kept going to meetings, calling my sponsor, reading the book, doing the stuff that you taught me to do that I'd become accustomed and comfortable doing. But I kept waiting to have to pick up that next drink, and I didn't find it necessary. And I didn't set myself, I've not yet set myself up for 25. It'd be a long time to not have taken a drink. Clearly, you won't have made the definition of an alcoholic by 25, because an alcoholic is somebody who, when they drink, can't stop drinking. Well, of course, what I've learned in the ensuing years is that's a setup. That's not the definition of an alcoholic is somebody who can't stop drinking. An alcoholic is somebody who, when they consume alcohol, has inappropriate things happen to them or does inappropriate things, one of which is the phenomena of craving. I can't stop drinking. But all kinds of other things take place when I drink, and this is better. My friend Bernardo, whenever you ask him how he is, his response is, compared to what? The way it used to be? This is better. That's my story. Joseph A. Jankowski, who resides in the big meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in heaven, I have it on good faith, would deem it acceptable as to its quantity of honesty and truthfulness. So I submit it for your consideration. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here.
This time I'll turn the meeting over for question and answers from our speaker.
There you go. silly as far as I'm concerned. Questions?
Yes, sir.
I'll call Eric.
Eric.
Thank you for your pitch. I really appreciate it. Enjoyed it. And I'm just curious if there's anything that you found that you do regularly that helps you in your daily routine or anything like that.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. Probably the most significant thing I do on a nearly daily basis is I do attend a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I found a 7 a.m. attitude adjustment meeting on the Whittier-La Habra border that I am a regular attendee. And if I'm in town, I'm in that meeting. That's my commitment to me, and it's my commitment to my sponsor who is routinely in that meeting. So daily attendance. And in addition to that, I think the other thing that I probably mentioned a while ago is don't say no to reasonable AA requests. If I'm asked, yes is the answer. Yes. Phyllis. Yeah, I could try. And I think it was the disease attempting to have its way with me one more time. I was about 8.5 years sober. I was sitting in our Tuesday night home meeting at that point, which is where I met the lovely redhead, by the way. So there is a reason to go to night meetings too, by the way. But I was sitting there and I watched a man take a chip and a cake for 10 years of sobriety, and that was far enough ahead of where I was at. Probably saw it as an impossibly long period of time, another year and a half to stay sober. But the definition, my faulty definition of an alcoholic jumped up, which is an alcoholic is somebody who can't stop drinking. Clearly, I mean, how much more evidence do you need, for God's sakes? After 10 years, you can stop drinking. That prima facie evidence is what an attorney would tell you, that you know, 10 years is too long to have just done it on willpower or a fluke or a trick or anything like that. So I allowed myself the idea that I could drink after 10 years. I didn't make a commitment. I didn't promise after 10 years I was going to drink. Fortunately, I didn't do that, but I allowed that. You know, that'd be okay. That'd be okay. And as I say, the net result is at 10 years, I just was uncomfortable. I had to tell everybody, my sponsor, ad nauseum, I had to tell him, I think I'm going to drink. I think I'm going to drink. I think I'm going to drink. And he just said, you know, that's nice. You can if you want to. Will I see you on Tuesday? But it was just... I'm in no hurry to have days go by, certainly not years go by, but it was an excruciatingly long year because I was in a lot of pain. Yeah. It's the best I got. Yes, sir.
Mike.
Well, I believe you're referring to the dreaded expectations. Yes, sir, absolutely, all the time. But the good news is I find myself doing that. In the old days, I wouldn't find myself. I would have found myself having done it after the fact kind of stuff. And today I've got a little bit more clarity and a little bit more understanding of my motives and my behavior. Even if I don't, my sponsor will lovingly point it out to me. Looks like what you really want, Jim, is blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, I'm guilty of that on a regular basis, but not acting too hard on it, too often on it, or dwelling on it too much. Redhead's name is Kim. You can check with her afterwards and verify the quality of that answer, because I'm, you know, of all the people in my life, I have the least amount of perspective on my life. I'm just, you know, I'm so busy actively involved in the, oh my God, look, it's almost lunch, kind of stuff that it's tough to, and to some extent, I don't want to be too far removed from my life. The purpose of life is to be lived, not to be analyzed, ad nauseum. Thoreau said, a life unexamined isn't worth living. Yes. Thank you. Wow. No. My dad was probably an alcoholic. He functioned really, really well, in spite of, because of, I'm not sure what, but he functioned really, really well. My dad did very, very well. The only reason, I have two resentments towards my dad, and both of them simply involve his passing. I didn't get sober before my dad died. It was a couple of years after my dad died that I finally found my way into Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom and my dad died within a short period of time of each other, and sometimes mad, resentful that that they didn't live long enough to see the son who I believed that they had always wanted. They lived a lifetime of having to find another attorney, come up with bail money, hide their heads in shame over the fact that I'd made the front page news, that kind of stuff. So, and my other resentment towards my dad is my dad never got to know my son, who is the apple of his daddy's eye. My son is 28 years old. When he was 17, as a English project in senior class, they had to write a letter. And I didn't know that. It's just, we were getting along fine at that point. But my kid, who was almost 4 years old when I got sober, wrote me a letter and mailed it. And it came to the house where we were all living. He, his mother, and I were all living. And I got home from work, and my then wife said, "There's a letter for you on the kitchen table. It looks like it's from Peter, our son." I looked and it's, yeah, it does look like his handwriting. She said, "Well, are you going to open it?" And I said, "Not right now. No, I'm busy right now." And the real reason is I wasn't going to open it is because I knew he'd just been accepted. Where's the other Kim with her hat? He'd just been accepted at Cal. He was going to move away and move to Berkeley. And I knew what was in that letter was he had taken my inventory. And I don't know why I knew that. I just knew it. Instinctively, I knew that he was finally going to say, in writing, all of the things to his dad that had been building up in him for 17, 18 years. He was gonna unload on me. And I had no intention of doing that in front of my wife. I was going to do that after everybody else went to bed. I certainly wasn't going to do it in front of him. I was going to do that after everybody went to bed and, decide how I was going to deal with it from then. Well, again, perception versus reality. Turned out that the assignment, the English class assignment, was write a letter to somebody. It's a long time ago, and I still have trouble with this. Write a letter to somebody in your life who has inspired you. And my son wrote about a 6 or 7 page letter to his dad, telling me in painfully exquisite detail all of the reasons why I had inspired him and how grateful he was. It's a kid who grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous, by the way, lest that go unsaid. And I was resentful at my dad, who died a year after my son, a little over a year after my son was born. I'm sad that my dad never got to meet his grandson, who's this magnificent man. I'm tragically sad that my son didn't get to meet his grandfather, who was this wonderful, wonderful guy who did everything he could to raise a household full of children and see us on the right path. And, you know, we are all on our own individual paths. But no, the Dranbuie never, ever, ever. Thank you. We're good?